Hi, I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There. This is a podcast about the outdoors, from your window box and garden, to the fields on the edge of town, to the forests, prairies, seashores, and wilderness. On the show, we explore our relationship with nature through stories, interviews, essays, and even some fiction. We travel around the U.S. and the world with tales of love and heartbreak, passion and adversity, desperation and triumph. Okay, so here's a question. What does the word conservation mean to you? For me, it always made me think of efforts to preserve pristine environments, to shield the wilderness from human activities. Our guest today has a different idea of what conservation should look like. Emma Maris is an environmental writer, and she's the author of a book called Rambunctious Garden. She argues that conservation shouldn't just focus on keeping things like they were back in the day. Instead, she says, we should embrace and even encourage change. Maris's vision for saving nature starts with redefining what it means for a place to be wild. We often think of wilderness as an area that's not affected by humans, but Maris says that definition is problematic.
There is no place on Earth that's not affected by humans. Even the places that are far away and look superficially completely unaffected, there's climate change there.
So what do you consider wild? What is wilderness?
When I think about wildness, I think what's most important to me is that it's autonomous, that it's not that's self-willed, that it's not being told what to do.
In other words, for Maris, a wild area is an area where humans are not actively meddling. Seems like a pretty straightforward definition. But Maris says it gets a bit tricky. That's because the places that seem most untouched, national parks, for example, are often carefully tended to keep them looking and functioning a certain way. Wildlife numbers are controlled, areas are burned to keep vegetation in line, there are strict rules about activities that you can and can't do.
So the places that we typically think of as the most wild, like Yellowstone or Yosemite, are actually really carefully managed by managers who are trying to keep it looking the way it did at a certain time. Other places that are not managed, you know, that are truly wild, they look pretty weird. They often have non-native species in them. They are sometimes described as trashy or degraded. And so as sort of climate change and land use change and species movements and as all those things kind of come together as actors on nature, you end up with this weird paradox where the places that we think of as wilderness are highly managed and the places that we think of as trash are really wild.
So why does all this matter? It's not just a question of semantics, it's a question of value. The places we consider wild are generally the places we work hardest to protect and preserve. Maris says that approach to conservation, where you focus on saving so-called pristine areas, has several problems.
One is sort of just conceptual, right? These areas that we have designated to ourselves as these pristine areas they're not pristine, they're often the relics of human management. Which doesn't mean that they're unworthy of protection. In fact, on the contrary, my point is that even places that have been changed by humans are worthy of protection and care. What I really want to do is expand out the kind of landscapes that we do conservation on. So if you look at a map of, for example, the designated wilderness or designated wilderness plus national parks or some of these different categories of protection on the landscape, it's still just not a lot of land compared to the total land mass. And I think that if we just do conservation on those little scraps of land that we try to hold to the past, we're not going to succeed. It's just not enough acreage. It's not enough connectivity. It's not enough habitat. We need to be doing conservation on all lands, including developed lands, including farms, including backyards. There's a role for all of these different kinds of spaces to play. And when we stop getting so hung up on the wilderness part or the pristine part, then we can kind of really dive into how do I make my backyard part of the conservation effort, or how do I make this little strip between, the Bed Bath and Beyond and the highway, how do I make that part of the conservation effort?
How big a difference can that strip of land next to Bed Bath and Beyond or my backyard make? Because obviously those are pretty small parcels of, I guess, natural areas. And usually when we think about conservation, we think about the need for sort of more space for ecosystems to exist and connect to each other.
Right. So if you're thinking about conserving grizzly bears, then right, your backyard is not a big part of the equation, but most of biodiversity is not big things. It's little things. It's plants, it's invertebrates, it's the little guys, it's, you know, soil microbes. And for that huge chunk of biodiversity, these areas can have a meaningful place. What's interesting is if you think about the concept of metapopulations. So metapopulations is a population of a species that's made up of a bunch of little populations of that species that are close enough together that they can kind of hop back and forth. And for something like a butterfly or for a wildflower species that's rare, backyards could make a great metapopulation.
So one of the things that you suggest is that instead of just focusing on saving ecosystems that may be in trouble, we should really be looking at creating new ecosystems, which you've called novel ecosystems. Why is that a good idea?
So the way that I think most ecologists now are using the phrase novel ecosystems is that it actually really captures this kind of new wilderness. So these are areas that have been influenced by human activities on a pretty broad scale. They're generally just packed with non-native species. But at the moment, they're not being actively managed by people. They're kind of doing their own thing. So we didn't maybe we planted the pine trees in a pine plantation, and then maybe we walked away from that. And maybe at the same time, some species were moving in from the south because the climate was changing. And maybe at the same time, someone just, you know, there's some escapees from somebody's garden, and so you've got some sort of weedy undergrowth species that are coming from Europe or from Asia, and those seeds blew in from the nearby suburban community. And you can, if you look around, these places are everywhere, and they're very common on the sort of urban edges. They are the places, the kind of weird wooded areas behind shopping malls, and they are what happens to an agricultural field when it gets abandoned. And these places are very dynamic, interesting places that have been virtually unstudied by ecologists because they're considered to be degraded, trashy landscapes. But the reason that I find them so fascinating is not just this romantic notion that they are kind of wild and self-willed, although I find that very appealing. It's also that we can just learn so much about how nature adapts, how the rest of nature adapts to the kind of pressures of climate change and species movements. I mean, these crazy novel ecosystems that's how nature's figuring out these problems. That's how it's responding to these challenges. And they turn out to be the few people who have studied them are surprised that they're pretty diverse and that they do sort of work together. You know, we think of ecosystems as something that take millennia to come together and that they're really tightly co-evolved. But it turns out you can also, I was in Hawaii and I was looking at some of these, and you'd have this Asian tree fern growing happily in a Hawaiian tree, or you'd have this Hawaiian tree growing happily in the dappled shade of an Australian tree. And then you'd have birds nesting in trees that were from different continents, and you'd have them eating fruit from a third continent and then dispersing those seeds. And then so these kind of crazy hybrid novel ecosystems do work together. They store carbon, they cycle nutrients, they create habitat for rare species. They can have all of these beneficial effects. And I'm not saying that we nominate these as our new national monuments and immediately embrace them as our aesthetic ideal. But I am saying that we should be kind of humble and realize that we're always not going to know. You know, maybe it's not the right thing for a certain place for us to sort of stand the line and say, no, we're going to keep this tree species here. We're going to keep this a forest instead of having it convert to a grassland, whatnot. If we look nearby, maybe we'll see that actually The ecosystem over there has flipped into a different state, but it's incredibly resilient, incredibly diverse. We can learn a lot from that. Maybe in 100 years from now, we'll be trying to manage to that novel ecosystem because it's so resilient and so diverse.
So to recap, what Maris is saying is that just because a landscape looks different than it used to, doesn't mean it's not valuable or worthy of protection. She says change in and of itself is not something to be afraid of. Ecosystems would change even if humans were not part of the equation. They've been doing it ever since ever. I mean, there used to be dinosaurs roaming the landscape.
Change is really a fundamental part of nature. And we cannot freeze nature in time. I think we can freeze nature maybe in really small areas, sort of these sort of museum-like parks. And I think we should, because I think we need to have them there as part of our culture. But they're really going to be almost cultural artifacts after another couple hundred years. And we also just need to realize that changed nature does not cease to be nature. So there was a Nature Conservancy poll some years ago where they asked teenagers whether or not they ever went outside, played outside, or recreated outside. And there was I think like the majority of them did not go outside for fun. And of those who did not, they asked them, why not? And there were a couple of different reasons, afraid of bugs and so on. But the one of the top reasons, and I think 66% of the respondents said, I don't go outside because there is no nature near me. And that's because they are not seeing the natural areas near them as nature because they're not good enough. They're not pure enough. They're not old growth or they're not pristine. They're messed up. You know, there's a city park near them. There's some sort of creek that runs behind the middle school near them. There are natural areas by them. They're just not seeing them. And I remember talking to I was chatting with a friend of mine. Our kids were playing in the backyard, and her daughter came in with this bouquet of flowers, and she had there was like some violets in there, and there was maybe some grape hyacinth, and then there were some dandelions in her bouquet. And this friend of mine accepted the bouquet, thanked her daughter, and then while we were talking, without even really looking, she just systematically removed every dandelion from the bouquet and threw them in the trash, and then put the bouquet in the vase. And I just thought it was so amazing because her daughter, you know, we don't start out distinguishing good plants from bad plants, evil, trashy nature from good nature. We start out loving all of it. And then we're systematically instructed to dislike certain chunks of nature. And that process slowly removes, the amount of nature that's available for us to connect with over time. There's an erosion there. And the more, yes, I think in some places we should be trying to keep native species around. We need to celebrate these species. We need to make sure that they are protected from long-term, from population declines and so on. I don't think we should let dandelions take over every landscape by any means. But we've got to pick our battles, and there are going to be places that are going to change, and they're going to look weird and weedy, and there's going to be some little mammal from the state to the south that we're not used to showing up. And that's nature too. That's nature adapting to what we have done to it. And in a way, we should be celebrating that, saying, look, nature is resilient. Not, this doesn't count.
Okay, so far we've been talking about the idea of protecting places that you wouldn't necessarily think are worthy of protection. In other words, protecting environments that are new and different from how they were before we messed with them. But Maris takes things a step further. She says we shouldn't just accept changes in nature. In some cases, we should actively create change. For example, let's say you have a species that can only survive at certain temperatures. Because of climate change, their environment is getting too hot and they're at risk for extinction. In a scenario like that, she says, it could make sense to move the species further north to a place where it's cooler. Assisted migration, as it were. This is a bold proposition and a controversial one. We spend vast amounts of time and money each year trying to remove so-called invasive species. The goal is to keep plants and animals where they belong, to keep them out of areas where they're not native. Land managers do this because when you introduce a species from one place into another, it can wreak havoc on the ecosystem. The non-native species will sometimes do so well that it will outcompete the native plants and animals. And that's bad because it can cause the ecosystem to be less diverse and less resilient. So Maris's idea of intentionally moving species around is pretty radical. But she says, at least in some cases, the benefits appear to outweigh the risks.
There's risks on both sides. If you don't move the species, you run a risk that it will go extinct. So, you know, it creates a real conundrum for conservationists because on the one hand, as you say, your choices are risk an extinction or risk creating a crazy invasion of a non-native species. And I think that obviously the fact that there's these risks on both sides means that these cases should be very carefully studied. There should be a lot of caution, a lot of sort of very careful trial runs. You shouldn't just throw a bunch of pikas in the back of your pickup truck and drive them to the next mountain. However, I tend to think, and I'm not alone in this, I think that there's a real shift in ecology on this question. I tend to think that the threat posed by non-natives is less intense than we have been told for many years. The vast majority of non-native species in all systems just show up and hang out and either survive or don't survive and don't cause big problems. It's only a small percentage that do cause problems. And then of those ones that are known to cause problems on continents, you know, they might be clogging pipes, as in the case of the zebra mussel, or they might be sort of smothering roadsides like kudzu. But they're typically not actually driving native species extinct or even threatening them with extinction. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't try to stop new introductions, because if your non-native species is outcompeting your natives and that's a problem for you and that doesn't fit with your goals for the site, then by all means, go out there with your machetes and your fire and get you know, I am not against control of non-native species at all when we know why we're doing it and when we're doing it for some reason that isn't just it's non-native. That's what really bothers me, is when the sort of prejudice against non-natives trumps any kind of reason that might have to do with actually what we want the site to function, how we want the site to function. So having said all that, I tend to think that when we're really faced with a situation where we have to choose between blurring the native, non-native line or saving a species that looks like it's really headed towards actual extinction, that we should move the species.
So in an ideal world, what does conservation look like for you?
Well, there's no point talking about an ideal world because that's not the world we live in. But what I would like to see happen is a little less emphasis on where things belong, you know, where they should be, and more emphasis on that they continue to persist in healthy populations. And one thing I want to make clear is that I don't think we should let everything go feral. I think that there's really still a very large role for sort of classical restoration to these more historical states that we're familiar with. And I also think that there's a role for sort of more experimental, moving things around and being kind of daring. And I think that the ideal management has all three approaches kind of spread out across the landscape. So I think that in some places we should aggressively intervene. In some places, we should do what we're used to doing, which is a sort of a classical restoration approach where we try to hold it to a particular historical baseline. And in some places, we should do nothing. We should just watch and see what nature does itself. And I would love to take credit for this notion of these three approaches across the landscape, but in fact, a guy named Greg Applett at the Wilderness Society in Colorado came up with this innovation, restoration, observation approach. And I think it's brilliant because we get to have our cake and eat it too. We get to have wildness and we get to save species. And I think that those are the sort of, for many people, those are the two core things that we want to do as conservationists. The trick is we don't get to have them in the same place.
So it seems like a lot of what you're proposing is basically saying, okay, the world is changing and has changed and we've changed things. We're causing climate change. We're developing whatever, and so here's how we need to sort of move forward from that. But isn't that in a way treating the symptoms rather than the disease? I mean, if we're talking about maybe moving a species around to keep it from going extinct because the climate is warming, isn't that sort of a temporary fix when what we really need to be dealing with is the climate is warming? How do we stop this? How do we fix it? We broke it. Shouldn't we fix it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, my focus in the book and in a lot of my work is sort of land management and resource, you know, what they call resource management in some agencies, and wildlife management. It's sort of what do you do with the species that you have and the land you have? But you are absolutely right. I mean, a huge part of this is our chances of success are much higher if we reduce the rapidity of change, if we calm things down a little bit and allow species a little more leisure to adapt to some of this. I mean, we've already committed to a certain level of warming. We can't undo it. But we could certainly stop further or more extreme warming. And I think that we ought to.
How did you get so interested in this topic? What's your background?
Well, I grew up in Seattle, and I trained as a science writer. So in the beginning of my career, I wrote about lots of different sciences. I wrote about chemistry, and I wrote about astronomy, and I wrote about a lot about animal behavior. But whenever I could cover something that was outside, I would cover that so I could go outside and look at the horizon and be among the trees and hang out with ecologists and go to field sites. And it's just way more interesting than being in a chemistry lab. Apologies to the chemists who are listening. So I started spending more and more time out in the field with ecologists. And it wasn't so much there, you know, what they were saying in the published literature that got me intrigued. It was what they were saying when we were just kind of driving to the site in their truck or hiking around or having a beer afterwards at the bar. Then they would start talking all about all these interesting questions about, you know, my reference site was actually modified by indigenous people, or I don't really know what the goal here should be. Should it be the way it looked like before the Polynesians came or after the Polynesians came? Or, you know, we are spending $80 million pulling out this shrub, and meanwhile, we don't have enough money to connect our park to the next park. You know, this sort of amount of money and energy that was being spent on non-native species removals, while all of these opportunities to connect natural areas were going unconnected, that was one thing that really began to motivate me. But ultimately, what I'm really interested in is being effective in preserving healthy, robust populations of other species.
I have to ask this because I assume that some listeners may be wondering, what gives you, as a writer, the authority to say, I think I've got a better solution than you, the scientist who spent your life studying this?
Well, first of all, it's not me. I mean, if you read the book, you'll see that basically what I'm doing is reporting on all these conservation biologists and ecologists who are starting to think about some of these different tools and approaches. And, you know, I get really excited and geek out about the ideas, but ultimately the ideas are coming out of the field. They are the working scientists and conservationists who are having these debates and coming up with these proposals. So, yeah, I don't have an ecology degree, but the people that I report on do. And the people who read my book and think that maybe there's something in there for them, they often have ecology degrees. I have had many land managers come up to me and say, well, I read your book, it changed the way I thought. Then when I went back to my board, I even changed how much money I was asking for non-native removal and changed how much money I was asking for land acquisition. And, you know, every once in a while I get an email from somebody either in the field or just a regular person who's read the book and who was in a really bleak place and feeling really checked out and really hopeless about everything. And they'll say that some of these new perspectives talking about creating, kind of co-creating with nature, kind of collaborating with nature and creating sort of resilient, diverse communities in the future, that vision really made them care again, kind of like brought them back from their depression about all this. And I have been there. I've been pretty depressed. I remember, you know, some evening sitting around drinking wine with my friends talking about how everything was just screwed, you know. And I feel more hopeful now. And I think sort of spreading that hope can be pretty powerful.
So what's the rambunctious garden?
Well, there's two rambunctious gardens that I had in mind when I titled the book. One is the whole earth. If a garden is a place that humans tend and care for and have influenced the placement of the plants, then the earth is sort of increasingly garden-like. I mean, a huge percentage of the earth is agriculture or planted forage for pasture. A huge percentage of the land cover, you know, what's growing there has been determined by humans. So we need to sort of start with that recognition, start with that understanding. But the rambunctious part is that just because there's a massive human influence on the planet doesn't mean that it's going to be a sterile place, or that it's going to be a place that just exists to serve us, just a heap of resources. It can still have wildness, and it can still have beauty and surprise and all of those things, even if that there's a strong human presence on the landscape. The other rambunctious garden is your garden. After you read the book and you decide to stop mowing your lawn and turning it into a mini biodiversity preserve, and sort of letting that wildness and that nature into your own space.
So on a very on an individual level, what should we all be doing with our backyards, or those of us who live in, or you know, people who live in cities, what should they be doing with their balconies or their rooftops?
Right. So I often say that, you know, my book is the official license to stop mowing your lawn. I know it doesn't always work if you're a renter, if you're the city code, you know, some inspector will come knock on your door, but a little less aggressive taming of the garden and taming of the window box and a little thinking about how can what I'm growing on my little piece of earth or my little box, how can that be part of an ecosystem? It is, even if you're in your Manhattan, your window box plants can serve pollinators. There's a huge diversity of pollinators right in the city. So when you know, should you choose to plant some sort of sterile hybrids from the big box store, or should you go plant something that the bees and the flies will love and that they can flourish on? Maybe you should plant some, you know, I'm not against native species, I'm all for native species. Maybe you should plant some native species in your yard. Maybe you should plant some species from the next USDA hardiness zone down, so that when the climate changes, they'll already have a little toehold in your area. And certainly what you should definitely do is just try to see the beauty in the sort of more untended and the more crazy and the more wild and the more feral. And not always reach for your clipper, your mower, and your pruner. You know, the messier it looks, the more biodiverse it is.
So at the end of most of my interviews, I usually ask my guest if there's anything else they'd like to say. When I asked Maris that question, she said yes. She has a special message for listeners of this podcast.
For your listeners who are people who like to spend as much time as possible in the outdoors, sort of my special message to them is to sort of challenge yourself to cultivate an appreciation for the outdoors that's not the gorgeous backpacking hike, and that's not the fabulous, you know, mountain bike track, and that's not the waterfall that you just spent like an entire weekend getting to, but that is that those little bits of nature that are on your daily commute or in your own yard or in the grocery store parking lot. Outdoors people have a huge appreciation for the natural beauty, but we mustn't let ourselves get too snobby.
All right, well, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
That was author and journalist Emma Maris. Her book is called Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. For over a decade, she's been writing for the journal Nature, and her work has also appeared in Wired, the Christian Science Monitor, and Conservation. If you want to read her work, you can go to our website, outthereshow.com, and we'll point you in the right direction. While you're there, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's discussion. What do you think of Maris's approach to conservation? You can leave comments on our website or Facebook page, or you can send us an email with your thoughts. Also, I'd like to thank Annie Stenzel, Jenny and Diego Cuenca, and James Pattison for their financial contributions to Out There. The types of stories you hear on the show take weeks, if not months, to put together, and gifts from listeners make this kind of journalism possible. If you like what you're hearing on the show, now is a great time to get in on the fun. To make a donation in any amount, just go to outthereshow.com and click support. For a gift of $50 or more, I'd be delighted to mention you on an upcoming episode of the podcast. That's it for this episode of Out There. We'll have a new show the second Thursday of every month. If you like what you heard, be sure to leave us a review on iTunes. We're hoping for 5 stars. Our theme music was written by Jared Arnold, and our website is outthereshow.com. If you have an idea for a story or interview, or you'd like to submit something you wrote, you can do so there. You can also follow me on Twitter at Willow Belden, or connect with the show on Facebook. Have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.